Sometimes Beth wondered what her life would be like if she were married. Not to her ex, of course. That thought made her shudder. Dealing with him every other weekend was more than enough, thank you very much. But to someone else, someone better. It seemed like it might be a good idea, at least in the abstract, anyway. After 10 years, she was used to her life, and though it might be nice to have someone to share her evenings with after working with work or get a back rub from now and then, there was also something nice about spending all day Saturday in her pajamas if she wanted to, which she sometimes did. Then, too, they called them lazy days. They were the best days ever. Sometimes they'd cap off a day of doing absolutely nothing by ordering pizza and watching a movie. Heavenly. Besides, if relationships were hard, marriage was even harder. It wasn't just Melody and David who struggled. It seemed like most couples struggled. It went with the territory. What did Nana always say? Stick two different people with two different sets of expectations under one roof, and it ain't always going to be shrimp and grits on Easter. Exactly. Even if she wasn't completely sure where Nana came up with her metaphors. Glancing at her watch, she knew that as soon as the party ended, she'd have to head back to check in on Nana. No doubt she'd find her in the kennel, either behind the desk or checking in the dogs. Nana was stubborn like that. Did it matter that her left leg could barely support her? My leg ain't perfect, but it's not beeswax either. Or that she might fall and get hurt? I'm not a bucket of fine china. Or that her left arm was basically useless? As long as I can eat soup, I don't need it anyway. She was one of a kind, bless her heart. Always had been. Hey, Mom! Lost in thought, she hadn't seen Ben approaching. His freckled face was shiny with sweat. Water dripped from his clothes, and there were grass stains on his shirt she was certain would never come out. Yeah, baby? Can I spend the night at Zach's tonight? I thought he had soccer practice. After practice. There's going to be a bunch of people staying over, and his mom got him Guitar Hero for his birthday. She knew the real reason he was asking. Not tonight. You can't. Your dad's coming to pick you up at 5. Can you call him and ask? I can try, but you know. Ben nodded, and as it usually did when this happened, her heart broke just a little. Yeah, I know. The sun glared through the windshield at baking temperature, and she found herself wishing she'd had the car's air conditioner fixed. With the window rolled down, her hair whipped in her face, making it sting. She reminded herself again to get a real haircut. She imagined saying to her hairdresser, "Chop it all off, Terry. Make me look like a man." But she knew she'd end up asking for her regular trim when the time came. In some things, she was a coward.
You guys look like you were having fun.
I was.
That's all you can say?
I'm just tired, Mom.
She pointed toward the Dairy Queen in the distance.
You want to swing by and get some ice cream?
It's not good for me.
Hey, I'm the mother here. That's what I'm supposed to say.
I was just thinking that if you're hot, you might want some.
I'm not hungry. I just had cake.
All right, suit yourself. But don't blame me if you get home and realize you should have jumped at the opportunity.
I won't.
He turned toward the window.
Hey, champ, you okay?
When he spoke, his voice was almost inaudible over the wind.
Why do I have to go to Dad's? It's not like we're going to do anything fun. He sends me to bed at 9 o'clock on Friday nights, like I'm still in second grade or something. I'm never even tired. And tomorrow, he'll have me do chores all day.
I thought he was taking you to your grandfather's house for brunch after church.
I still don't want to go.
I don't want you to go either, she thought. But what could she do?
Why don't you bring a book?
She suggested.
You can read in your room tonight, and if you get bored tomorrow, you can read there too.
You always say that. Because I don't know what else to tell you, she thought.
You want to go to the bookstore?
No, he said, but she could tell he didn't mean it.
Well, come with me anyway. I want to get a book for myself.
Okay. I'm sorry about this, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Going to the bookstore did little to lift Ben's mood. Though he'd ended up picking out a couple of Hardy Boys mysteries, she'd recognized his slouch as they'd stood in line to pay for them. On the ride home, he opened one of the books and pretended to be reading. Beth was pretty sure he'd done it to keep her from peppering him with questions or trying, with forced cheerfulness, to make him feel better about his overnight at his dad's. At 10, Ben was already remarkably adept at predicting her behavior. She hated the fact that he didn't like going to his dad's. She watched him walk inside their house, knowing that he was heading to his room to pack his things. Instead of following him, she took a seat on the porch steps and wished for the thousandth time that she'd put up a swing. It was still hot, and from the whimpering coming from the kennel across the yard, it was clear that the dogs, too, were suffering from the heat. She strained for the sound of Nana inside. Had she been in the kitchen when Ben walked through, she definitely would have heard her. Nana was a walking cacophony. Not because of the stroke, but because it went part and parcel with her personality. 76 going on 17. She laughed loud, banged pans with a spoon when she cooked, adored baseball, and turned the radio up to ear-shattering levels whenever NPR featured the big band era. Music like that doesn't just grow like bananas, you know. Until the stroke, she'd worn rubber boots, overalls, and an oversized straw hat nearly every day, tromping through the yard as she taught dogs to heel or come or stay. Years ago, along with her husband, Nana had taught them to do pretty much everything. Together, they'd bred and trained hunting dogs, service dogs for the blind, drug-sniffing dogs for the police, security dogs for home protection. Now that he was gone, she did those things only occasionally. Not because she didn't know what to do. She'd always handled most of the training anyway. But to train a dog for home protection took 14 months, and given the fact that Nana could fall in love with a squirrel in less than 3 seconds, it always broke her heart to give up the dog when the training was completed. Without Grandpa around to say, "We've already sold him, so we don't have a choice," Nana had found it easier to simply fold that part of the business. Instead, these days, Nana ran a thriving obedience school. People would drop off their dogs for a couple of weeks, doggy boot camp, she called it, and Nana would teach them how to sit, lie down, stay, come, and heal. They were simple, uncomplicated commands that nearly every dog could master quickly. Usually, somewhere between 15 and 25 dogs cycled through every 2 weeks, and each one needed roughly 20 minutes of training per day. Any more than that, and the dogs would lose interest. It wasn't so bad when they were 15, but boarding 25 made for long days, considering each dog also needed to be walked. And that didn't factor in all the feeding, kennel maintenance, phone calls, dealing with clients, and paperwork. For most of the summer, Beth had been working 12 or 13 hours a day. They were always busy. It wasn't difficult to train a dog. Beth had been helping Nana on and off since she was 12, and there were dozens of books on the subject. In addition, the veterinary clinic offered lessons for dogs and their owners every Saturday morning for a fraction of the price. Beth knew that most people could spare 20 minutes a day for a couple of weeks to train their dog, but they didn't. Instead, people came from as far away as Florida and Tennessee to drop off their dogs to have someone else do it. Granted, Nana had a great reputation as a trainer, but she was really only teaching dogs to sit and come, heal and stay. It wasn't rocket science. Yet people were always extremely grateful and always, always amazed. Beth checked her watch. Keith, her ex, would be here soon. Though she had issues with the man, Lord knows she had serious issues. He had joint custody, simple as that, and she'd tried to make the best of it. She liked to tell herself that it was important for Ben to spend time with his dad. Boys needed to spend time with their dads, especially those coming up on their teenage years, and she had to admit that he wasn't a bad guy. Immature, yes, but not bad. He had a few beers now and then, but wasn't an alcoholic. He didn't take drugs. He had never been abusive to either of them. He went to church every Sunday. He had a steady job and paid his child support on time, or rather his family did. The money came from a trust, one of many that the family had established over the years. And for the most part, he kept his never-ending string of girlfriends away on those weekends he spent with his son. Key words, for the most part. Lately, he'd been better about that, but she was fairly sure it had less to do with a renewed commitment to parenting than the likelihood that he was between girlfriends right now. She wouldn't really have minded so much, except for the fact that his girlfriends were usually closer in age to Ben than they were to him, and as a general rule, had the IQs of salad bowls. She wasn't being spiteful. Even Ben realized it. A couple of months back, Ben had to help one of them make a second batch of Kraft macaroni and cheese after the first attempt burned. The whole add milk, butter, mix, and stir sequence was apparently beyond her. That wasn't what bothered Ben the most, however. The girlfriends were okay. They tended to treat him more like a younger brother than a son. Nor was he truly upset about the chores. He might have to rake the yard or clean the kitchen and take out the trash, but it wasn't as if her ex treated Ben like an indentured servant. And chores were good for him. Ben had weekend chores when he was with her, too. No, the problem was Keith's childish, relentless disappointment in Ben. Keith wanted an athlete. Instead, he got a son who wanted to play the violin. He wanted someone to hunt with. He got a son who would rather read. He wanted a son who could play catch or shoot baskets. He was saddled with a clumsy son with poor vision. He never said as much to Ben or to her, but he didn't have to. It was all too apparent in the scornful way he watched Ben play soccer, in the way he refused to give Ben credit when he won his last chess tournament, in the way he continually pushed Ben to be someone he wasn't. It drove Beth crazy and broke her heart at the same time, but for Ben, it was worse. For years, he tried to please his dad, but over time, it had just exhausted the poor kid. Take learning to play catch. No harm in that, right? Ben might learn to enjoy it. He might even want to play Little League. Made perfect sense when her ex had suggested it. And Ben was gung-ho in the beginning. But after a while, Ben came to hate the thought of it. If he caught three in a row, his dad would want him to try to catch four. When he did that, it had to be five. When he got even better, his dad wanted him to catch all of them, and then catch while he was running forward, catch while he was running backward, catch while he was sliding, catch while he was diving, catch the one his dad threw as hard as he could. And if he dropped one, you'd think the world was coming to an end. His dad wasn't the kind of guy who'd say, "Nice try, champ," or "Good effort." No, he was the kind of guy who'd scream, "Come on, quit screwing up." Oh, she'd talk to him about it. Talk to him ad nauseam. It went in one ear and out the other, of course. Same old story. Despite, or perhaps because of, his immaturity, Keith was stubborn and opinionated about many things, and raising Ben was one of them. He wanted a certain kind of son, and by God, he was going to get him. Ben, predictably, began reacting in his own passive-aggressive way. He began to drop everything his dad threw, even simple lobs, while ignoring his father's growing frustration, until his father finally slammed his glove to the ground and stormed inside to sulk the rest of the afternoon. Ben pretended not to notice, taking a seat beneath a lob lolly pine to read, until she picked him up a few hours later. She and her ex didn't battle just about Ben. They were fire and ice as well. As in, he was fire and she was ice. He was still attracted to her, which irritated her no end. Why on earth could he believe that she'd want anything to do with him was beyond her. But no matter what she said to him, it didn't seem to deter his overtures. Most of the time, she could barely remember the reasons she'd been attracted to him years ago. She could recite the reasons for marriage. She'd been young and stupid, foremost among them, and pregnant to boot. But nowadays, whenever he stared her up and down, she cringed inside. He wasn't her type. Frankly, he'd never been her type. If her entire life had been recorded on video, the marriage would be one of those events she would gladly record over. Except for Ben, of course. She wished her younger brother Drake were here, and she felt the usual ache when she thought of him. Whenever he'd come by, Ben followed him around the way the dogs followed Nana. Together they would wander off to catch butterflies or spend time in the treehouse that Grandpa had built, which was accessible only by a rickety bridge that spanned one of the two creeks on the property. Unlike her ex, Drake accepted Ben, which, in a lot of ways, made him more of a father to Ben than her ex had ever been. Ben adored him, and she adored Drake for the quiet way he built confidence in her son. She remembered thanking him for it once, but he just shrugged. "I just like spending time with him," he'd said, by way of explanation. She knew she needed to check on Nana. Rising from her seat, she spotted the light on in the office, but she doubted that Nana was doing paperwork. More likely, she was out in the pens behind the kennels, and she headed in that direction. Hopefully, Nana hadn't got it in her mind to try and take a group of dogs for a walk. There was no way she could keep her balance, or even hold them, if they tugged on the leashes. But it had always been one of her favorite things to do. She was of the opinion that most dogs didn't get enough exercise, and the property was great for remedying that. At nearly 70 acres, it boasted several open fields bordered by virgin hardwoods, crisscrossed by half a dozen trails, and two small streams that flowed all the way to the South River. The property, bought for practically nothing 50 years ago, was worth quite a bit now. That's what the lawyer said. The one who'd come by to feel Nana out about the possibility of selling it. She knew exactly who was behind all that. So did Nana, who pretended to be lobotomized while the lawyer spoke to her. She stared at him with wide, blank eyes, dropped grapes onto the floor one by one, and mumbled incomprehensibly. She and Beth giggled about it for hours afterward. Glancing through the window of the kennel office, she saw no sign of Nana, but she could hear Nana's voice echoing from the pens.
"Stay. Come. Good girl. Good come."
Rounding the corner, Beth saw Nana praising a Shih Tzu as it trotted toward her. It reminded her of one of those wind-up toy dogs you could purchase from Walmart.
"What are you doing, Nana? You're not supposed to be out here."
"Oh, hey, Beth."
Unlike 2 months ago, now she hardly slurred her words anymore. Beth put her hands on her hips.
"You shouldn't be out here alone."
"I brought a cell phone. I figured I'd just call if I got into a problem."
"You don't have a cell phone."
"I have yours. I snuck it out of your purse this morning."
"Then who would you have called?"
She hadn't seemed to have considered that, and her brow furrowed as she glanced at the dog.
"See what I have to put up with, Precious? I've told you the gal was sharper than the digging caterpillar."
She exhaled, letting out a sound like an owl. Beth knew a change of subject was coming.
"Where's Ben?"
she asked.
"Inside, getting ready. He's going to his dad's."
"I'll bet he's thrilled about that. You sure he's not hiding out in the treehouse?"
"Go easy," Beth said. "He's still his dad."
"You think?"
"I'm sure."
"Are you positive you didn't mess around with anyone else back then? Not even a single one-night stand with a waiter or a trucker or someone from school?"
She sounded almost hopeful. She always sounded hopeful when she said it.
"I'm positive, and I've already told you that a million times."
She winked.
"Yes, but Nana can always hope your memory improves."
"How long have you been out here, by the way?"
"What time is it?"
"Almost 4 o'clock."
and I've been out here 3 hours.
In this heat?
I'm not broken, Beth. I had an incident.
You had a stroke.
But it wasn't a serious one.
You can't move your arm.
As long as I can eat soup, I don't need it anyway. Now, let me go see my grandson. I want to say goodbye to him before he leaves.
They started toward the kennel, Precious trailing behind them, panting quickly, her tail in the air. Cute dog.
I think I want Chinese food tonight, Nan said. Do you want Chinese?
I haven't thought about it.
Well, think about it.
Yeah, we can have Chinese, but I don't want anything too heavy. And not fried, either. It's too hot for that.
You're no fun.
But I'm healthy.
Same thing. Hey, and since you're so healthy, would you mind putting Precious away? She's in number 12. I heard a new joke I want to tell Ben.
Where did you hear a joke?
The radio.
Is it appropriate?
Of course it's appropriate. Who do you think I am?
I know exactly who you are. That's why I'm asking. What's the joke?
Two cannibals were eating a comedian, and one of them turns to the other and asks, "Does this taste funny to you?"
Beth chuckled.
He liked that.
Good. The poor kid needs something to cheer him up.
He's fine.
Yeah, sure he is. I didn't just fall off the milk cart, you know.
As they reached the kennel, Nana kept walking toward the house, her limp more pronounced than earlier this morning. She was improving, but there was still a long way to go. Chapter 4 Tebow. The Marine Corps is based on the number 3. It was one of the first things they taught you in basic training, made things easy to understand. 3 Marines made a fire team. 3 fire teams made a squad. 3 squads made a platoon. 3 platoons made a company. 3 companies made a battalion, and 3 battalions made a regiment. On paper, anyway. By the time they invaded Iraq, their regiment had been combined with elements from other units, including the Light Armored Reconnaissance Battalion, firing battalions of the 11th Marines, the 2nd and 3rd Assault Amphibian Battalions, Company B from the 1st Combat Engineer Battalion, and the Combat Service Support Battalion 115. Massive. Prepared for anything. Nearly 6,000 personnel in total. As Tebow walked beneath a sky beginning to change colors with the onset of dusk, he thought back to that night, technically his first combat in hostile territory. His regiment, the 1st 5th, became the first unit to cross into Iraq with the intention of seizing the Ramallah oil fields. Everyone remembered that Saddam Hussein had set most of the wells in Kuwait on fire as he'd retreated in the first Gulf War, and no one wanted the same thing to happen again. Long story short, the 1st 5th, among others, got there in time. Only 7 wells were burning by the time the area was secured. From there, Tebow's squad, among others, was ordered north to Baghdad to help to secure the capital city. The 1st 5th was the most decorated Marine regiment in the Corps, and thus was chosen to lead the deepest assault into enemy territory in the history of the Corps. His first tour in Iraq lasted a little more than 4 months. 5 years after the fact, most of the specifics about that first tour had blurred. He had done his job and eventually was sent back to Pendleton. He didn't talk about it. He tried not to think about it. Except for this. Ricky Martinez and Bill Kincaid, the other 2 men in Tebow's fire team, were part of a story he'd never forget. Take any 3 people, stick them together, and they're going to have differences. No surprise there. And on the surface, they were different. Ricky grew up in a small apartment in Midland, Texas, and was a former baseball player and weightlifting fanatic who'd played in the Minnesota Twins farm system before enlisting. Bill, who played the trumpet in his high school marching band, was from upstate New York and had been raised on a dairy farm with 5 sisters. Ricky liked blondes. Bill liked brunettes. Ricky chewed tobacco, and Bill smoked. Ricky liked rap music. Bill favored country western. No big deal. They trained together, they ate together, they slept together. They debated sports and politics. They shot the breeze like brothers and played practical jokes on each other. Bill would wake with one eyebrow shaved off. Ricky would wake the next night with both of them gone. Tebow learned to wake at the slightest sound and somehow kept both eyebrows intact. They laughed about it for months. Drunk one night, they got matching tattoos, each proclaiming their fidelity to the core. After so much time together, they got to the point where they could anticipate what the others would do. Each of them, in turn, had saved Tebow's life, or at least kept him from serious harm. Bill grabbed the back of Tebow's flak jacket just as Tebow was poised to move into the open. Moments later, a sniper wounded two men nearby. The second time, a distracted Tebow was almost struck by a speeding Humvee driven by a fellow Marine. That time, it was Ricky who grabbed his arm to stop him. Even in war, people die in auto accidents. Look at Patton. After securing the oil fields, they had arrived at the outskirts of Baghdad with the rest of their company. The city had not fallen yet. They were part of a convoy, three men among hundreds, tightening their grip on the city. Aside from the roar of Allied vehicle engines, all was quiet as they entered the outlying neighborhoods. When gunfire was heard from a graveled road off the main thoroughfare, Tebow's squad was ordered to check it out. They evaluated the scene. Two- and three-story buildings sandwiched together on either side of the potholed road. A lone dog eating garbage. The smoking ruins of a car 100 meters away. They waited, saw nothing. Waited some more, heard nothing. Finally, Tebow, Ricky, and Bill were ordered to cross the street. They did so, moving quickly, reaching safety. From there, the squad proceeded up the street into the unknown. When the sound of gunfire rang out again that day, it wasn't a single shot. It was the death rattle of dozens and then hundreds of bullets from automatic weapons, trapping them in a circle of gunfire. Tebow, Ricky, and Bill, along with the rest of the squad across the street, found themselves pinned in doorways with few places to hide. The firefight didn't last long, people said later. It was long enough. The blizzard of fire cascaded from windows above them. Tebow and his squad instinctively raised their weapons and fired, then fired again. Across the street, two of their men were wounded, but reinforcements arrived quickly. A tank rolled in, fast-moving infantry in the rear. The air vibrated as the muzzle flashed and the upper stories of a building collapsed, dust and glass filling the air. Everywhere Tebow heard the sounds of screaming, saw civilians fleeing the buildings into the streets. The fusillade continued. The stray dog was shot and sent tumbling. Civilians fell forward as they were shot in the back, bleeding and crying out. A third Marine was injured in the lower leg. Tebow, Ricky, and Bill were still unable to move, imprisoned by the steady fire chipping at the walls next to them, at their feet. Still, the three of them continued to fire. The air vibrated with a roar, and the upper floors of another building collapsed. The tank, rolling forward, was getting close now. All at once, enemy gunfire started coming from two directions, not just one. Bill glanced at him. He glanced at Ricky. They knew what they had to do. It was time to move. If they stayed, they would die. Tebow rose first. In that instant, all went suddenly white, then turned black. In Hampton, more than 5 years later, Tebow couldn't recall the specifics, other than the feeling that he'd been tossed into a washing machine. He was sent tumbling into the street with the explosion, his ears ringing. His friend Victor quickly reached his side. So did a naval corpsman. The tank continued to fire, and little by little, the street was brought under control. He learned all this after the fact, just as he learned that the explosion had been caused by an RPG, a rocket-propelled grenade. Later, an officer would tell Tebow that it had most likely been meant for the tank. It missed the turret by inches. Instead, as if fated to find them, it flew toward Tebow, Ricky, and Bill. Tebow was loaded into a Humvee and evacuated from the scene unconscious. Miraculously, his wounds had been minor, and within 3 days he would be back with his squad. Ricky and Bill would not. Each was later buried with full military honors. Ricky was a week away from his 22nd birthday. Bill was 20 years old. They were neither the first casualties of the war nor the last. The war went on. Tebow forced himself not to think about them much. It seemed callous, but in war the mind shuts down about things like that. It hurt to think about their deaths, to reflect on their absence, so he didn't. Nor did most of the squad. Instead, he did his job. He focused on the fact that he was still alive. He focused on keeping others safe. But today he felt the pinpricks of memory and loss, and he didn't bury them. They were with him as he walked the quiet streets of town, making for the outskirts on the far side. Following the directions he'd received from the front desk at the motel, he headed east on Route 54, walking on the grassy shoulder, staying well off the road. He'd learned in his travels never to trust drivers. Zeus trailed behind, panting heavily. He stopped and gave Zeus some water, the last in the bottle. Businesses lined either side of the highway, a mattress shop, a place that did auto body repairs, a nursery, a quick-and-go that sold gas and stale food in plastic wrappers, and two ramshackle farmhouses that seemed out of place, as if the modern world had sprouted up around them, which was exactly what had happened, he assumed. He wondered how long the owners would hold out or why anyone would want to live in a home that fronted a highway and was sandwiched between businesses. Cars roared past in both directions. Clouds began to roll in, gray and puffy. He smelled rain before the first drop hit him, and within a few steps it was pouring. It lasted 15 minutes, drenching him, but the heavy clouds kept moving toward the coast until only a haze remained. Zeus shook the water from his coat. Birdsong resumed from the trees while mist rose from the moist earth. Eventually, he reached the fairgrounds. It was deserted. Nothing fancy, he thought, examining the layout, just the basics. Parking on a dirt gravel lot on the left, a couple of ancient barns on the far right, a wide grassy field for carnival rides separating the two, all lined with a chain-link fence. He didn't need to jump the fence. Nor did he need to look at the picture. He'd seen it 1,000 times. He moved forward, orienting himself, and eventually he spotted the ticket booth. Behind it was an arched opening where a banner could be strung. When he arrived at the arch, he turned toward the northern horizon, framing the ticket booth and centering the arch in his vision, just as it had appeared in the photograph. This was the angle, he thought. This was where the picture had been taken. The structure of the Marines was based on threes. 3 men to a fire team, 3 fire teams to a squad, 3 squads to a platoon. He served 3 tours in Iraq. Checking his watch, he noted that he'd been in Hampton for 3 hours, and straight ahead, right where they should have been, were 3 evergreen trees. Clustered together. Tebow walked back to the highway, knowing he was closer to finding her. He wasn't there yet, but he soon would be. She'd been here. He knew that now. What he needed now was a name. On his walk across the country, he'd had a lot of time to think, and he decided there were 3 ways to go about it. First, he could try to find a local veterans association and ask if any locals had served in Iraq. That might lead into someone who might recognize her. Second, he could go to the local high school and see if it had copies of yearbooks from 10 to 15 years ago. He could look through the photographs one by one. Or third, he could show the photograph and ask around. All had their drawbacks. None were guaranteed. As for the Veterans Association, he hadn't found one listed in the phone book. Strike one. Because it was still summer vacation, he doubted if the high school would be open. Even if it was, It might be difficult to gain access to the library's yearbooks. Strike two. For now, anyway. Which meant that his best bet was to ask around and see if anyone recognized her. Who to ask, though? He knew from the almanac that 9,000 people lived in Hampton, North Carolina. Another 12,000 people lived in Hampton County. Way too many. The most efficient strategy was to limit his search to the likeliest pool of candidates. Again, he started with what he knew. She appeared to be in her early 20s when the photograph had been taken, which meant she was in her late 20s now, possibly early 30s. She was obviously attractive. Further, in a town this size, assuming an equal distribution among age brackets, that meant there were roughly 2,750 kids, from newborns up to 10 years of age, 2,750 from 11 to 20, and 5,500 people in their 20s and 30s, her age bracket, roughly. Of those, he assumed half were males and half were females. Females would tend to be more suspicious about his intentions, especially if they actually knew her. He was a stranger. Strangers were dangerous. He doubted they would reveal much. Men might, depending on how he framed the question. In his experience, nearly all males noticed attractive females in their age bracket, especially if they were single men. How many men in her current age group were single? He guessed about 30%. Might be right, might be wrong, but he'd go with it. Say, 900 or so. Of those, he figured 80% had been living here back then. Just a guess, but Hampton struck him as a town that people were more likely to emigrate from as opposed to immigrate to. That brought the number down to 720. He could further cut that in half if he concentrated on single men aged 25 to 35 instead of 20 to 40. That brought it down to 360. He figured a good chunk of those men either knew her or knew of her 5 years ago. Maybe they'd gone to high school with her, or maybe not. He knew there was one in town, but they would know her if she was single. Of course, it was possible she wasn't single. Women in small southern towns probably married young, after all. But he would work with this set of assumptions first. The words on the back of the photograph, "Keep safe," E, didn't strike him as romantic enough to have been given to a boyfriend or fiancé. No, love you. No, I'll miss you. Just an initial. A friend. Down from 21,000 to 360 in less than 10 minutes. Not bad. And definitely good enough to get started. Assuming, of course, she lived here when the photograph had been taken. Assuming she hadn't been visiting. He knew it was another big assumption, but he had to start someplace. And he knew she'd been here once. He would learn the truth, one way or the other, and move on from there. Where did single men hang out? Single men who could be drawn into conversation. I met her a couple of years ago, and she told me to call her if I got back into town, but I lost her name and number. Bars. Pool halls. In a town this size, he doubted whether there were more than three or four places where locals hung out. Bars and pool halls had the advantage of alcohol, and it was Saturday night. They'd be filled. He figured he'd have his answer, one way or the other, within the next 12 hours. He glanced at Zeus. Seems like you're going to be on your own tonight. I could bring you, but I'd have to leave you outside, and I don't know how long I'll be. Zeus continued walking, his head down, tongue out. Tired and hot. Zeus didn't care. I'll put the air conditioner on, okay? Chapter 5 Clayton. It was 9 o'clock on Saturday night, and he was stuck at home babysitting. Great. Just great. How else could a day like today end, though? First, one of the girls almost catches him taking pictures. Then the department's camera gets stolen. And then Logan Thibault flattens his tires. Worse, he'd have to explain both the loss of the camera and the tires to his dad, Mr. County Sheriff. Predictably, his dad was spitting mad and somehow didn't buy the story he'd concocted. Instead, he just kept peppering him with questions. By the end, Clayton had wanted to pop the old man. Dad might be a bigwig to a lot of the folks around here, but the man had no business talking to him like he was an idiot. But Clayton had kept to his story. He thought he'd seen someone, gone to investigate, and somehow run over a couple of nails. And the camera? Don't ask him. He had no idea if it had even been in the cruiser in the first place. Not great, he knew, but good enough.
That looks more like a hole made by a buck knife, said his dad, bending down, examining the tires. I told you it was nails. There's no construction out there. I don't know how it happened either. I'm just telling you what happened.
Where are they?
How the hell should I know? I pitched them in the woods.
The old man wasn't convinced, but Clayton knew enough to stick to his story. Always stick to the story. It was when you started backtracking that people got in trouble. Interrogation 101. Eventually, the old man left, and Clayton put on the spares and drove to the garage, where they patched the original tires. By then, a couple of hours had passed, and he was late for an appointment with one Mr. Logan Thibault. Nobody, but nobody, messed with Keith Clayton. Especially not some hippie drifter who thought he could put one over on him. He spent the rest of the afternoon driving the streets of Arden, asking whether anyone had seen him. Dude like that was impossible to miss, if only because of Cujo by his side. His search yielded Zippo, which only infuriated him further, since he realized that it meant Thibault had lied to his face and Clayton hadn't picked up on it. But he'd find the guy. Without a doubt, he'd find the guy. If only because of the camera, or more accurately, the pictures, especially the other pictures. Last thing he wanted was for Thibault to stroll into the sheriff's department and drop that baby on the counter, or even worse, head straight to the newspaper. Of the two, the department would be the lesser of two evils, since his dad could keep a lid on it, while his dad would blow a gasket and most likely put him on some crap detail for the next few weeks. He'd keep it quiet. His dad wasn't good for much, but he was good for things like that. But the newspaper, now that was a different story. Sure, Gramps would pull some strings and do his best to keep it quiet there, too, but there was no way that sort of information could be kept in check. It was just too juicy, and the news would spread like wildfire through this town, with or without an article. Clayton was already regarded as the black sheep of the family, and the last thing he needed was another reason for Gramps to come down on him. Gramps had a way of dwelling on the negative. Even now, years later, Gramps was still bent that he and Beth had divorced, not that it was even his business. And at family gatherings, he could usually be counted on to bring up the fact that Clayton hadn't gone to college. With his grades, Clayton could easily have handled it. But he simply couldn't imagine spending another 4 years in the classroom, so he joined his father at the sheriff's department. That was enough to placate Gramps. It seemed like he'd spent half his life placating Gramps. But he had no choice in the matter. Even though he didn't particularly like Gramps, Gramps was a devout Southern Baptist who went to church every Sunday and thought that drinking and dancing were sins, which always struck Clayton as ridiculous. He knew what Gramps expected of him, and let's just say that taking nudie pictures of coeds was not on the to-do list. Nor were some of the other photos on the disc, especially of him and a few other ladies in compromising positions. That sort of thing would definitely lead to serious disappointment, and Gramps wasn't very patient with those who disappointed him, even if they were family, especially if they were family. Claytons had lived in Hampton County since 1753. In many ways, they were Hampton County. Family members included judges, lawyers, doctors, and landowners. Even the mayor had married into the family. But everyone knew Gramps was the one who sat at the head of the table. Gramps ruled the place like an old-fashioned mafia don, and most people in town sang his praises and went on and on about what a quality man he was. Gramps liked to believe it was because he supported everything from the library to the theater to the local elementary school. But Clayton knew the real reason was that Gramps owned pretty much every commercial building in the downtown area, as well as the lumber yard, both marinas, three automobile dealerships, three storage complexes, the only apartment complex in town, and vast tracts of farmland. All of it made for an immensely wealthy and powerful family. And since Clayton got most of his money from the family trusts, the last thing he needed was some stranger in town making trouble for him. Thank God he'd had Ben in the short time he'd been with Beth. Gramps had this weird thing about lineage, and since Ben had been named after Gramps, a pretty slick idea if he did say so himself, Gramps adored him. Most of the time, Clayton had the sense that Gramps liked Ben, his great-grandson, a lot more than he liked his grandson. Oh, Clayton knew Ben was a good kid. It wasn't just Gramps. Everyone said so. And he did love the kid, even if he was a pain in the ass sometimes. From his perch on the front porch, he looked through the window and saw that Ben had finished with the kitchen and was back on the couch. He knew he should join him inside, but he wasn't ready just yet. He didn't want to fly off the handle or say something he'd regret. He'd been working at being better about things like that. A couple of months back, Gramps had had a little talk with him about how important it was to be a steady influence. Peckerhead. What he should have done was talk to Ben about doing what his dad asked when he asked, Clayton thought. Would have been a lot more good. The kid had already pissed him off once tonight, but instead of exploding, he'd remembered Gramps and pressed his lips together before stalking outside. Seemed like he was always getting pissed off at Ben these days. But it wasn't his fault. He honestly tried to get along with the kid, and they'd started out okay. Talked about school, had some burgers, tuned into Sports Center on ESPN. All good. But then, horror of horrors, he'd asked Ben to clean the kitchen. Like that was too much to ask, right? Clayton hadn't had the chance to get to it for the last few days, and he knew the kid would do a good job. So Ben promised he'd clean it, but instead of doing it, he just sat there. And sat. And the clock ticked by. And then he'd sat some more. So Clayton had asked again. He was sure he'd said it nicely. And though he couldn't be certain, he was pretty sure that Ben had rolled his eyes and he'd finally trudged off. That was all it took. He hated when Ben rolled his eyes at him, and Ben knew he hated it. It was like the kid knew exactly which buttons to push, and he spent all his spare time trying to figure out new buttons to hit the next time he saw him. Hence, Clayton had found himself on the porch. Behaviors like that were his mom's doing. Of that, Clayton had no doubt. She was one hell of a good-looking lady, but she didn't know the first thing about turning a young boy into a man. He had nothing against the kid getting good grades, but he couldn't play soccer this year because he wanted to play the violin? What kind of crap was that? Violin? Might as well start dressing the boy in pink and teaching him to ride side saddle. Clayton did his best to keep that sort of pansy stuff in check. But the fact was, he had the kid only a day and a half every other weekend. Not his fault the kid swung a bat like a girl. Kid was too busy playing chess. And just so everyone was clear, there was no way on God's green earth that he'd be caught dead at a violin recital. Violin recital, good Lord, what was this world coming to? His thoughts circled back to Thibault again, and though he wanted to believe the guy had simply left the county, he knew better. The guy was walking, and there was no way he could reach the far side of the county by nightfall. And what else? Something had been gnawing at him most of the day, and it wasn't until he'd come to cool off on the porch that he'd figured it out. If Thibault had been telling the truth about living in Colorado, and granted, he might not have been, but let's say he was, it meant he'd been traveling from west to east. And the next town east? Not Arden, that's for sure. That was southwest from where they'd met. Instead, heading east would have brought the guy to good old Hampton, right here, his hometown, which meant, of course, the guy might be less than 15 minutes from where he was sitting now. But where was Clayton? Out searching for the guy? No, he was babysitting. He squinted through the window again at his son. He was reading on the couch, which was the only thing the kid ever seemed to want to do. Oh, yeah, except for the violin. He shook his head, wondering if the kid had gotten any of his genes at all. Not likely. He was a mama's boy through and through. Beth's son. Beth. Yeah, the marriage didn't work, but there was still something between them. There always would be. She may have been preachy and opinionated, but he'd always watch out for her. Not only because of Ben, but because she was surely the best-looking woman he'd ever slept with. Great-looking back then, and somehow even better-looking now. Even better-looking than the co-eds he'd seen today. Weird. Like she had reached an age that suited her perfectly, and somehow stopped aging after that. He knew it wouldn't last. Gravity would take its toll, but still, he couldn't stop thinking about having a quick roll in the sack with her. One for old time's sake, and to help him unwind. He supposed he could call Angie, or Kate for that matter. One was 20 and worked in the pet store. The other was a year older and cleaned toilets at the Stratford Inn. They both had nice little figures and were always dynamite when it came time for a little bit of unwinding. He knew Ben wouldn't care if he brought one of them over, but even so, he'd probably have to talk to them first. They'd been pretty angry at him the last time he'd seen either of them. He'd have to apologize and turn on the charm, and he wasn't sure he was up to listening to them smack their chewing gum and chatter away about what they'd seen on MTV or read in the National Enquirer. Sometimes they were too much work. So that was out. Searching for Thibault tonight was out. Looking for Thibault tomorrow was out, too, since Gramps wanted everyone over for brunch after church. Still, Thibault was walking, and with the dog and the backpack, it meant catching a ride was unlikely. How far could he get by tomorrow afternoon? 20 miles? 30 at the most? No more than that, which meant he was still in the vicinity. He'd make some calls to a couple of other departments in the surrounding counties, ask them to keep an eye out. There weren't that many roads leading out of the county, and he figured that if he spent a few hours making phone calls to some of the businesses along those routes, someone would spot the guy. When that happened, he'd be on his way. Thibault never should have messed with Keith Clayton. Lost in thought, Clayton barely heard the front door squeak open.
Hey, Dad?
Yeah. Someone's on the phone. Who is it?
Tony.
Of course it is. He rose from his seat, wondering what Tony wanted. Talk about a loser. Scrawny and pimpled. He was one of those hangers-on who sat near the deputies, trying to worm his way into pretending he was one of them. He was probably wondering where Clayton was and what he was doing later because he didn't want to be left out. Lame. He finished his beer on the way in and tossed it in the can, listening to it rattle. He grabbed the receiver from the counter. Yeah. In the background, he could hear the distorted chords of a country western song playing on a jukebox, and the dull roar of loud conversation. He wondered where the loser was calling from.
Hey, I'm at Decker's Pool Hall, and there's this strange dude here that I think you should know about.
His antenna went up. Does he have a dog with him? Backpack? Kind of scruffy? Like he's been out in the woods for a while?
No.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. He's shooting pool in the back. But listen, I wanted to tell you he's got a picture of your ex-wife.
Caught off guard, Clayton tried to sound nonchalant. So? He said.
I just thought you'd want to know.
Why would I give a holy crap about that?
I don't know.
Of course you don't. Holler. He hung up the phone, thinking the guy must have potato salad where his brain should be, and ran an appraising gaze over the kitchen. Clean as could be. kid did a great job, as usual.
He almost shouted that out from where he stood, but instead, as he caught sight of Ben, he couldn't help but notice again how small his son was.
Granted, a big chunk of that might be genetics, early or late growth spurts and all that, but another part came from general health. It was common sense. Eat right, exercise, get plenty of rest. The basics. Things everyone's mother told their kids. And mothers were right. If you didn't eat enough, you couldn't grow. If you didn't exercise enough, your muscles stagnated. And when do you think a person grew? Night. When the body regenerated. When people dreamed. He often wondered whether Ben got enough sleep at his mom's. Clayton knew Ben ate. He finished his burger and fries, and he knew the kid was active. So maybe lack of sleep was keeping him small. Kid didn't want to end up short, did he? Of course not. And besides, Clayton wanted a bit of alone time, wanted to fantasize about what he was going to do to Thibault the next time he saw him. He cleared his throat.
Hey, Ben, it's getting kind of late, don't you think?
Chapter 6 Tebow. On his way home from the pool hall, Tebow remembered his second tour in Iraq. It went like this. Fallujah, spring 2004. The 1st-5th, among other units, was ordered in to pacify the escalating violence since the fall of Baghdad the year before. Civilians knew what to expect and began to flee the city, choking the highways. Maybe a third of the city evacuated within a day. Airstrikes were called in, then the Marines. They moved block by block, house by house, room by room, in some of the most intense fighting since the opening days of the invasion. In 3 days, they controlled a quarter of the city, but the growing number of civilian deaths prompted a ceasefire. A decision was made to abandon the operation, and most of the forces withdrew, including Tebow's company. But not all of his company withdrew. On the second day of operations, at the southern industrial end of town, Tebow and his platoon were ordered to investigate a building rumored to hold a cache of weapons. The particular building hadn't been pinpointed, however. It could be any of a dozen dilapidated structures clustered near an abandoned gas station, forming a rough semicircle. Tebow and his platoon moved in, toward the buildings, giving the gas station a wide berth. Half went right, half went left. All was quiet, and then it wasn't. The gas station suddenly exploded. Flames leapt toward the sky, the explosion knocking half of the men to the ground, shattering eardrums. Tebow was dazed. His peripheral vision had gone black and everything else was blurry. All at once, a hail of fire poured from the windows and rooftops above them, and from behind the burned-out remains of automobiles in the streets. Tebow found himself on the ground beside Victor. Two of the others in his platoon, Matt and Kevin, Mad Dog and K-Man, respectively, were with them, and the training of the Corps kicked in. The Brotherhood kicked in. Despite the onslaught, despite his fear, despite an almost certain death, Victor reached for his rifle and rose to one knee, zeroing in on the enemy. He fired, then fired again, his movements calm and focused, steady. Mad Dog reached for his rifle and did the same. One by one they rose. One by one fire teams were formed. Fire, cover, move. Except they couldn't move. There was no place to go. One Marine toppled, then another, then a third and a fourth. By the time reinforcements arrived, it was almost too late. Mad Dog had been shot in the femoral artery. Despite having a tourniquet, he'd bled to death within minutes. Kevin was shot in the head and died instantly. 10 others were wounded. Only a few emerged unscathed. Tebow and Victor were among them. In the pool hall, one of the young men he'd spoken with reminded him of Mad Dog. They could have been brothers, same height and weight, same hair, same manner of speaking. And there had been an instant there where he'd wondered whether they were brothers before telling himself that it simply wasn't possible. He'd known the chance he was taking with his plan. In small towns, strangers are always suspect, and toward the end of the evening, He'd seen the skinny guy with bad skin make a call from the payphone near the bathroom, eyeing Tebow nervously as he did so. He'd been jumpy before the call as well, and Tebow assumed the call had been either to the woman in the photograph or to someone close to her. Those suspicions were confirmed when Tebow had left. Predictably, the man had followed him to the door to see which way he was walking, which was why Tebow had headed in the opposite direction before doubling back. When he'd arrived at the run-down pool hall, he'd bypassed the bar and made straight for the pool tables. He quickly identified the guys in the appropriate age group, most of whom seemed to be single. He asked to join in and put up with the requisite grumbling, made nice, bought a few rounds of beers while losing a few games at pool, and sure enough, they began to loosen up. Casually, he asked about the social life in town. He missed the necessary shots. He congratulated them when they made a shot. Eventually, they started asking about him. Where was he from? What was he doing here? He hemmed and hawed, mumbling something about a girl, and changed the subject. He fed their curiosity. He bought more beers, and when they asked again, he reluctantly shared his story, that he'd gone to the fair with a friend a few years back and met a girl. They'd hit it off. He went on and on about how great she was, and how she'd told him to look her up if he ever came to town again. And he wanted to, but damned if he could remember her name. "You don't remember her name?" they asked. "No," he answered. "I've never been good with names. I got hit in the head with a baseball when I was a kid, and my memory doesn't work so good." He shrugged, knowing they would laugh, and they did. "I got a photo, though," he added, making it sound like an afterthought. "Do you have it with you?" "Yeah, I think I do." He rummaged through his pockets and pulled out the photo. The men gathered around. A moment later, one of them began shaking his head. "You're out of luck," he said. "She's off limits." "She's married?" "No, but let's just say she doesn't date. Her ex wouldn't like it. And trust me, you don't want to mess with him." Tebow swallowed. "Who is she?" "Beth Green," they said. "She's a teacher at Hampton Elementary and lives with her grandma in the house at Sunshine Kennels." Beth Green. Or more accurately, Tebow thought, Elizabeth Green. E. It was while they were talking that Tebow realized one of the people he'd shown the picture to had slipped away. "I guess I'm out of luck then," Tebow said, taking back the photo. He stayed for another half hour to cover his tracks. He made more small talk. He watched the stranger with the bad skin make the phone call and saw the disappointment in his reaction, like a kid who got in trouble for tattling. Good. Still, Tebow had the feeling he'd see the stranger again. He bought more beers and lost more games, glancing occasionally at the door to see if anyone arrived. No one did. In time, he held up his hands and said he was out of money. He was going to hit the road. It had cost him a little more than $100. They assured him he was welcome to join them any time. He barely heard them. Instead, all he could think was that he now had a name to go with the face, and that the next step was to meet her. Chapter 7 Beth Sunday. After church, it was supposed to be a day of rest, when she could recover and recharge for the coming week. The day she was supposed to spend with her family, cooking stew in the kitchen and taking relaxing walks along the river. Maybe even cuddle up with a good book while she sipped a glass of wine, or soak in a warm bubble bath. What she didn't want to do was spend the day scooping dog poop off the grassy area where the dogs trained, or clean the kennels, or train 12 dogs one right after the other, or sit in a sweltering office waiting for people to come pick up the family pets that were relaxing in cool, air-conditioned kennels, which of course was exactly what she'd been doing since she'd gotten back from church earlier that morning. 2 dogs had already been picked up, but 4 more were scheduled for pickup sometime today. Nana had been kind enough to lay out the files for her before she retreated to the house to watch the game. The Atlanta Braves were playing the Mets. And not only did Nana love the Atlanta Braves with a feverish passion that struck Beth as ridiculous, but she loved any and all memorabilia associated with the team, which explained, of course, the Atlanta Braves coffee cups stacked near the snack counter, the Atlanta Braves pennants on the walls, the Atlanta Braves desk calendar, and the Atlanta Braves lamp near the window. Even with the door open, the air in the office was stifling. It was one of those hot, humid summer days, great for swimming in the river, but unfit for anything else. Her shirt was soaked with perspiration, and because she was wearing shorts, her legs kept sticking to the vinyl chair she sat in. Every time she moved her legs, she was rewarded with a sort of sticky sound, like peeling tape from a cardboard box, which was just plain gross. While Nana considered it imperative to keep the dogs cool, she'd never bothered to add cooling ducts that led to the office.
"If you're hot, just prop the door to the kennels open," she'd always said,
ignoring the fact that while she didn't mind the endless barking, most normal people did. And today there were a couple of little yappers in there, a pair of Jack Russell Terriers that hadn't stopped barking since Beth had arrived. Beth assumed they'd bark nearly all night, since most of the other dogs seemed grumpy as well. Every other minute or so, other dogs joined in an angry chorus, the sounds rising in pitch and intensity, as if every dog's sole desire was to voice its displeasure more loudly than the next, which meant there wasn't a chance on earth that she was going to open the door to cool off the office. She toyed with the idea of going up to the house to fetch another glass of ice water, but she had the funny feeling that as soon as she left the office, the owners who'd dropped off their Cocker Spaniel for obedience training would show up. They'd called half an hour ago telling her that they were on their way. "We'll be there in 10 minutes." And they were the kind of people who would be upset if their Cocker Spaniel had to sit in a kennel for a minute longer than she had to, especially after spending 2 weeks away from home. But were they here yet? Of course not. It would have been so much easier if Ben were around. She'd seen him in church that morning with his father, and he'd looked as glum as she'd expected. As always, it hadn't been a lot of fun for him. He'd called before going to bed last night and told her that Keith had spent a good chunk of the evening sitting alone on the porch outside while Ben cleaned the kitchen. What, she wondered, was that about? Why couldn't he just enjoy the fact that his son was there, or simply sit and talk with him? Ben was just about the easiest kid to get along with, and she wasn't saying that because she was biased. Well, okay, she admitted. Maybe she was a little biased, but as a teacher, she'd spent time with lots of different kids, and she knew what she was talking about. Ben was smart. Ben had a zany sense of humor. Ben was naturally kind. Ben was polite. Ben was great, and it made her crazy to realize that Keith was too dumb to see it. She really wished she were inside the house doing something, anything. Even doing laundry was more exciting than sitting out here. Out here, she had way too much time to think. Not only about Ben, but about Nana, too. And about whether she would teach this year. And even the sad state of her love life, which never failed to depress her. It would be wonderful, she thought, to meet someone special, someone to laugh with, someone who would love Ben as much as she did. Or even to meet a man with whom she could go to dinner and a movie. A normal man. Like someone who remembered to put his napkin in his lap in a restaurant and opened a door for her now and then. That wasn't so unreasonable, was it? She hadn't been lying to Melody when she'd said her choices in town were slim, and she'd be the first to admit that she was picky. But aside from the short time with Adam, she'd spent every other weekend at home this past year. 49 out of 52 weekends. She wasn't that picky, that's for sure. The simple fact was that Adam had been the only one who'd asked her out. And for a reason she still didn't understand, he'd suddenly stopped calling, which pretty much summed up the story of her dating life the last few years. But no big deal, right? She'd survived without a relationship this long, and she'd soldier on. Besides,